Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kalb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest, Susan Chomsky, who is the author of Awaken Your Third Eye, How Accessing Your Sixth Sense Can Help You Find Knowledge, Illumination, and Intuition. Susan is the award-winning author of 11 books, including The Power of Chakras, The Power of Auras, and Ascension. And she has a long history of study with the Maharishi Yogi, who was the guru of the Beatles, and Deepak Chopra. And this is probably, as far as I know, one of the best books I've ever read on awakening your third eye. It spans many different religions, many different spiritual disciplines, and scientific information, and is full of exercises and other advice on how to not only how to open your third eye, but also what it means to awaken your third eye. Thank you, Susan, for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here with you today, Susan.
Well, can you tell the listening audience a little bit about how you got interested in spiritual illumination?
Yes, it was 1960s. I was a hippie. I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. It was the coming up to the Summer of Love, actually. It was 1966, mm-hmm. which was a year before the Summer of Love. And those people in your audience probably do not understand that those of us who were hippies, who were flower children, we were really very serious about studying Eastern philosophy, Eastern wisdom. We wanted mm-hmm. to become spiritually awakened and enlightened. So I was reading books like the Buddhist scriptures. I was reading Tibetan Book of the Dead. I was reading Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. Mm-hmm. I was reading The Way of Zen by Alan Watts. And in the book, The Way of Zen, it said that you need to find a meditation guide. Well, in 1966 in Berkeley, California, you didn't go to the yellow pages and look up meditation guide or anything
right.
remotely similar to that. So I asked a roommate, you know, how do I find this meditation guide? And he said, well, have you ever tried to do it on your own? And I said, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. Why not? So I lay down on my bed. I didn't even know that you're supposed to sit up when you meditate. So I lay on my bed and I sort of prayed for or asked for a meditation. Immediately, I was propelled into this ecstatic state. I was feeling this cord of energy rushing from the tips of my toes all the way to the top of my head. I felt like I was plugged into an electric socket, but in the most ecstatic way. Mm-hmm. And so this energy was rushing up through my body. And so I figured, well, I guess this is meditation. Little did I know that I had just had my first meditation experience and also my first Kundalini awakening all at the same time. So it was not long after that that a friend took me to the Transcendental Meditation Center, and I saw the photo of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi on the wall of the center, and I knew immediately that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to learn TM, meditation mm-hmm. technique that he taught. And so I did. And then a few years after that, I was on the banks of the Ganges River studying with him to become a teacher of transcendental meditation. So that's pretty much how it all happened.
Well, back in the 60s, the Maharishi was the center of Western attention in terms of spiritual development. He actually brought it to the West along with Yogananda. Those two
right.
were actually specifically mm-hmm. guided to come here,
yeah.
spiritual guidance to come
Kananda.
Here.
Kananda.
That's true.
Vivekananda first, then Yogananda, and then Maharishi. But Maharishi made a much bigger impact because by that time there was television, there was media, you know, the kind of media that we have.
Yeah.
So
and the Maharishi, scientists and people who are associated with the Maharishi have done probably more to study what meditation is than any other group. I know the PET scans and the spectra scans that are done showing what meditation is, and just very interesting research done by that group.
Yeah, they did over 500 research studies, and they published, and so it was pretty extraordinary, and really made meditation a household word in the 20th century. So I think that Maharishi single-handedly changed the world in a way, because he introduced meditation to so many millions of people.
So what was your first book? Was it...
Oh, okay. My first book was Divine Revelation, which was published by Simon & Schuster. And that book is the main textbook for what I teach, which is Divine Revelation. And Divine Revelation is a method for listening to the divine voice within, for developing your intuition and for developing your connection to spirit, and being able to distinguish and discern between that true divine voice and other voices in your mind, and learning how to test whether the message you get is the real thing, and how to open to that, how to receive those divine messages from within. So that was the first book.
I like the what you have in the Awaken Your Third Eye, which probably stems from that, is that you receive information through your senses, and people tend to, like I have more clairaudience, although I do have clairvoyance as well, but it's more like flashes, it's more like visions, very quick visions that are very, very, very clear, but most of the information I receive is clairaudient. But you also talk about other ways of receiving information. Would you like to go through those for people?
Well, yeah, there's clairvoyance, which means clear seeing in French, which means seeing with your inner eye. Usually you see in the area of your forehead, or you might see somewhere else in your body, or you can see anywhere, but usually it's kind of seeing in your mind's eye. And then clairaudience, that means hearing with the inner voice. That means hearing the inner voice with your, you can say, your inner ear, meaning it's just like any other thought that floats into your mind, but it is a thought coming from spirit with a capital F. So that would be clairaudience. And then clairsentience would be just getting gut feelings. Just, you have a sensing of something. For example, if you walk into a room, you have a sensing of the vibration in that room. What does it feel like? What are the people in the room? What do they feel like? You know. So that would be clairsentience. Most people are clairsentient more than anything else. So those are the three basic ways that we receive intuitive messages. And my teachings, Divine Revelation, and my other book, How to Hear the Voice of God, and Now Awaken Your Third Eye, it's about receiving these at will. You know, people often have experiences, but they're not really at will, or they're not intentional. What I do is help people to be able to do this whenever you want, to ask and receive whenever you want. And in fact, the main premise of everything that I teach is simply ask and it shall be given unto you. So by asking, you do receive.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how literal that command is, or that suggestion. It's in the Bible. It's probably another religious text as well, that really we need to ask. If we don't ask, we don't necessarily have the ability to, or the opportunity to have the experience.
Well, the amazing thing, Susan, is that you know, people pray and they ask for things and they have intentions for things, and eventually they do get those things. So in the material world, it takes some time usually to get things. But in the spiritual world, when you ask, you get it immediately. You get immediate results. And people don't realize how easy it is to ask and receive when you are in the spiritual world.
That's true. And you can really get quick results. Usually when I'm asking, I get it within hours, you know, or right away. But if I ask for an external sign, I'll often get it within hours. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you if you'd ever had anybody describe this with clairaudience. I was actually up in the Great Smokies Mountains at a spiritual retreat, and I was meditating, and I felt something turn in my left ear. I actually felt something turn inside the ear, and then I had pretty complete spiritual hearing from that point on. Had you ever heard that kind of like on-off switch in the ear?
I hadn't, but that's really cool. That's a great experience. That's very interesting.
It was. But it was
really,
literally something
really
inside my ear that I felt turning.
Like it switched on suddenly.
Switched on. Yeah.
That's very cool.
It did. And it was in a vortex. We were up in a vortex, so that was very interesting.
That's great.
Yeah, it was fun. So let's go back to awakening your third eye. In it, you describe some of the physical attributes of the pineal gland, where it is, what its function is, and what relationship it has to developing spiritual sight. Would you like to just review that?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that the third eye is something that's in your subtle body. You have this gross physical body, and then you also have a subtle body. And the subtle body permeates and surrounds the physical body. And in this subtle body, there are several layers or sheets in the subtle body. One of those sheets is called the energy body. It's known in India as the pranamaya kosha. And kosha means sheath. And prana is the life force energy that flows through that layer of the subtle body. And prana is the same. In India, they call it prana, life force energy. In China, they call it qi. And in Japan, they call it qi. So that subtle life force energy is flowing through the subtle body in specific conduits of energy, or like tubes, energy tubes. By the way, these are invisible, and they are in another dimension. This is a subtle body. This is not your gross physical body. But this life force energy is flowing through these conduits. In India, they call them nadi, and in China, they call them acupuncture meridians. They call them meridians. So this life force energy is flowing through the subtle body. Now, where many of these conduits meet together and form a plexus, that's called a chakra. Mm-hmm. So the chakra, there are seven major ones in your subtle body. And the chakra are what's running your physical body, by the way. These chakra are regulating your physical body. In China, they call these acupuncture points. In India, they call them chakra. So the chakra is pretty well known. And one of your chakra is your third eye. Your third eye is called the Ajna chakra. It's spelled A-J-N-A, and it's pronounced Ajna. So the Ajna chakra is your third eye chakra. And it is located in the center of your brain, specifically in the third eye area, and specifically your pineal gland. And it's associated with other glands in your head, too, like the thalamus, hypothalamus, and that sort of thing. So the third eye really is in the very center of your head and the pineal gland, but it also extends to your forehead and to the back of your head. Now, it is associated with the pineal gland. It has been associated with the pineal gland for millennia. The ancients knew about it in India. They knew about the pineal gland in China. The ancient Greeks knew about it. Plato wrote about it, and he wrote about the chakras. He wrote about the pineal gland. The Greeks call it the pineal gland because it looks like a pine cone or a pine nut. And in fact, it is really where the third eye is located in the physical body. But you have to remember that your third eye is not in your physical body. It's in your subtle body. If you were to dissect a corpse, you would not find a third eye anywhere. You would find a pineal gland, but you would not find a third eye, in that you're not going to find the chakra or the nadis or anything like that. And the third eye is actually the chakra. It's in your subtle body. However, the endocrine system is associated with your chakras. So the third eye chakra is associated with the pineal gland.
So the pineal gland is known to produce melatonin. And also, I believe it's called, DMT. Is that right? The spirit hormone?
Now, that is a very interesting subject you just brought up. Because in 2013, there was a stunning discovery made. Rick Strassman, who wrote the book, The Spirit and Molecule, he and his research group called the Cottonwood Research Group, they were doing research, and what they found was in rodents, not in humans, but in rodents, they found that DMT is produced by the pineal gland. Now, this is a stunning discovery. DMT is dimethyltryptamine. DMT was very popular in the 1960s as a psychedelic drug. It's still being used as a psychedelic drug. It's an illegal substance. And tourism has been booming in the Amazon because people from America and other Western countries are now flocking to the Amazon basin to experiment with ayahuasca. And ayahuasca is plant medicine that has been used by the shamanic tribes, the Aguarana Indians, since 500 BC. In that area. And so people are going down there to have ayahuasca ceremonies. And ayahuasca is made of various plants that have psychedelic properties. And in fact, the chemical composition of ayahuasca is mainly DMT, so dimethyltryptamine. So people are having these out-of-body experiences. They're having experiences of other dimensions. They're having higher states of consciousness or altered states of consciousness. They're having experiences of otherworldly spiritual beings, or maybe even demonic beings, all kinds of just non-physical experiences from using this substance. Well, so now we're hearing the science is proving that DMT is being produced in the pineal gland of a mammal, the rodent. So it's not a far-gone conclusion to realize that, yes, of course, human beings are also producing it, because if a rat is producing it, so are we. So that is such an amazing discovery, because what it does is it's showing us that the third eye truly is associated with the pineal gland. Because the pineal gland is now producing a chemical that causes people to have otherworldly experiences. So now we see the connection here, that we are producing endogenously, that means self-producing, producing ourselves, this substance that's causing us to have spiritual awakening and spiritual experiences, and it's called DMT. So this is amazing.
Yeah, actually, each chakra is probably associated with an endocrine organ, though, right?
It is, exactly.
Yeah.
Every single one of the, well, I shouldn't say each chakra, each of the major chakras.
Each of the major chakras, right.
Seven major chakras are associated with a endocrine gland, yes. And then there's hundreds of minor chakras as well.
Right.
But in my book, The Power of Chakras, I wrote the book, The Power of Chakras. And in that book, I talk about the 14 major chakras that are talked about in the ancient scriptures of India, where I went back to the tantric and the Vedic scriptures, and I found the most authentic information I could find on the subject. And so it's like an encyclopedia. All the so-called experts on chakras, they use my book as their reference because it has so much information about all the various chakras and the energy, the whole energy system that we reside in or live in, and it keeps us alive, actually.
I also wanted to mention that even Christianity is tied to this information, because during the secret years that really much isn't written about of Jesus Christ, he spent time in India studying this. One of my good friends is Tricia McCannon, who actually wrote a book on those secret years where he spent time in India and in the Ireland and in Egypt. Would you like to review the information you have in your book about how Jesus studied the information that was in India, and how he then helped that, probably that practice helped him attain a spiritual state where he could perform the miracles and you know, go on with his mission?
Oh, yes. I wrote a book called Ascension, and in that book, I discuss, one of the things I do discuss in the book Ascension is the lost years of Jesus. There was a monastery, it's in Ladakh, in Leh, L-E-H, in Ladakh, India. And in that monastery, it was found a manuscript. And the manuscript is called The Life of Saint Issa, I-S-S-A. You can actually look that up on the internet, and you can read the whole manuscript. It doesn't take very long to read. It's a short book, or more like a pamphlet, really. And you can read that and read the entire history of Jesus in India, where he visited many sacred places there. And he actually, not only did he learn the siddhis or the perfections, the supernormal powers, but he also taught, because he taught monism. He taught because he was not into the whole idea of idolatry and many gods and so forth. So he taught monism or monism to people in India. And so that was... that was something he did. And he also traveled to some other places like Iran and other places in the area. And so I suggest that people just find that book online. It's called The Life of Saint Issa, and it is a manuscript that was located in the late 1800s in that monastery. And it gives the indication that he was actually there. He traveled there. And talks about all of his teachings and what he did in those lost, so-called lost years.
Yeah, I just think it's important to tie all that together, that actually probably most of the major religions at their crux or at their core have all of these concepts when... they may be secret doctrines. They may not be widely taught to the masses, but the adepts of these religions are all exposed to the same principles.
Very much so. I mean, you know, Joseph Campbell wrote extensively about how all the religions are tied together. They all have the same myths, so-called myths or legends, and they teaching them basically the same thing. And that includes Judeo-Christianity. It's not just, you know, things of ancient lore and so on. It's all tied together.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one thing that I started to study even back in high school, and correlating these different things amongst the different religions. Because, really, if you're going to try to, you know, ascertain the truth is going to be the same no matter what filter it goes through. And if you see that what's similar in all of the religions, then that is probably a spiritual truth.
Absolutely. Sure.
So would you like to talk a little bit about, I guess, through different, the two different religions that you referenced here was Taoism and Buddhism, how they reference the third eye and the spiritual enlightenment that can occur when one awakens the third eye.
Yes, the third eye is very well known to not only Hinduism, but also, and Ayurvedic medicine, but also Chinese medicine, and Taoism, and Buddhism, obviously. So you'll see, for example, statues of the Buddha with the third eye, like a dot on his forehead or a bump on his forehead that represents the third eye. And you'll see people all over the Far East, especially in India, they'll be wearing a dot in the center of their forehead that represents the third eye. And in my book, Awaken Your Third Eye, I teach methods from various traditions, from the yoga tradition of India, and methods from Taoism to help you to awaken the third eye. And also I talk about in the Yoga Sutras, which teach specific methods for awakening the third eye. And in fact, I give readers a key to use the Yoga Sutras. People have tried to read the Yoga Sutras for centuries, but they have no clue what it means and how to actually use those aphorisms that are written in the Yoga Sutras. The Yoga Sutras is a scripture written by Patanjali, and it's an ancient scripture, and it actually teaches these supernormal powers, or what we might call subtle sensory perception or supersensory perception, and how to develop that through specific methods that he calls, the method that he calls Sanyama, which consists of three parts to it. And I actually teach people how to do that in my book, Awaken Your Third Eye. I give the key to that, which is, it's just, you're not going to find it anywhere else. You're not going to learn how to do that because it's just so esoteric. But it just so happens that my guru taught us how to do this. And he brought back that kind of ancient knowledge. And in fact, people were using these sutras. When I was in the ashram, we used them to attain higher consciousness and to develop these subtle sensory perceptions. So that's something extraordinary. And then also I teach something called the microcosmic orbit that's in the Taoist tradition. I teach a kind of a basic form of that, which is a visualization where you are using energy and flowing it through the body in a specific circuit of energy. And that also helps us to awaken the third eye. But one of the main practices that helps you to awaken the third eye is yoga practices, such as the bandhas and the asanas and pranayama. Asanas, people are more familiar with asanas, which are yoga postures. And some of the postures, such as the shoulder stand, are very good, or the plow, are very good for awakening the third eye. But also there is these bandhas, the Uddiyana bandha, Vindalandhara bandha, and the Mula bandha, Mahabandha. These will help people to very quickly awaken Kundalini and open the third eye. So, and in a safe way, by the way. Everything that's in this book, Awaken Your Third Eye, can be done safely and can be done yourself without having to, study with a spiritual master or anything. You can just use the book and do it. So the bandhas are specifically designed for awakening Kundalini, and they're very powerful. And bandhas means muscular locks. So it's kind of muscular locks where you're squeezing certain muscles that help to kind of push the Kundalini along, shall we say, and up the center of the center channel that's in your subtle body. And then there's also another really great thing for opening the third eye is the Trataka meditation. And Trataka meditation is basically gazing at an object. For example, you can sit in a kind of a darkened room or even in the dark and just sit in front of a mirror and gaze at your own reflection in the mirror and look at your forehead with soft focused vision. And when you gaze at that mirror, you'll begin to awaken your clairvoyant sight. Now, how is mirror gazing done? Well, the soft focus vision is the key to it. Now, if you've ever seen one of these magic eye pictures, the magic eye pictures are like these different color blocks, just like different odd blocks of color. It looks like an abstract picture. But when you actually gaze at it with soft focus vision, a three-dimensional object will pop out of the picture, and suddenly you'll see this, I don't know, unicorn or a heart or just some odd picture will pop out in three dimensions. And how that works is that your eyes, when you use your eyes to focus on an object, the eyes converge in one point. Mm-hmm. However, your eyes, there are two of them. So if you actually allow the eyes to completely relax and kind of go out of focus, what happens is one eye is seeing one picture and the other is seeing another picture. And that would be called soft focus vision. And if you can perhaps practice with the magic eye pictures and then also use a tratika meditation such as the mirror gazing, where you're just gazing with soft focus vision in your forehead, that will help you to develop this ability to use soft focus vision, which is the key to being able to see with clairvoyant sight with your eyes, with, in other words, being able to see outwardly. It's much easier for people to see clairvoyantly with their eyes closed rather than their mm-hmm. eyes open. It's easier to see auras with your eyes closed rather than open. So that's mm-hmm. a key that your listeners might, use that in a practical way and just do an experiment, some of these experiments that I'm suggesting. And also, as far as pratika meditation, you can gaze at various things. You can gaze at the moon. You can gaze at the horizon. You can gaze at a picture of a divine being. You can gaze at a dot on the wall. You can gaze at just about anything, and that'll help you to develop your clairvoyant sight.
So I did want to mention that there are extensive exercises in your book, and I plan to do some of these exercises with my meditation group. I think that if anybody has a meditation group, that these exercises would be great to do as, not only learning, but just to get, because when you do them by yourself, you have an experience, but when you do them in a group of, say, six or eight people, everybody has an experience, so, and then you can share your experiences, so that would be good.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that because we were just getting back to Jesus in India, because mm-hmm. it was in a different book, I didn't really have it at my fingertips, but I did pull it out. And let me just tell you a couple more details about this Saint Issa. It was a Russian physician. His name was Nicholas Notovich, and he published a book called The Unknown Life of Christ. And that was published in 1894. And he traveled all over India, and when he visited this Buddhist convent in a place called Himis, H-I-M-I-S, which is near Leh, L-E-H, and that's the capital of Ladakh, L-A-D-A-K-H, in India. And that's where he found some ancient volumes which had 200 verses, and it was called The Life of Saint Issa. And that described the travels of Jesus during his lost years, as that was between the ages of 13 and 29. Mm-hmm. And this was later confirmed by a couple different people, one of which was Nicholas Roerich, who was a very famous painter, who mm-hmm. traveled to India, Nicholas Roerich, and also Swami Abedananda. They also independently traveled to this place, this convent at Himis, and they found the same text. And according to this text, Jesus, known as Issa there, he spent 6 years in Varanasi and also in Rajagriha and in the temple of Jagannath in Orissa and other holy cities, and there he studied the Vedas. And he obviously also studied the Yoga Sutras, because he learned all these siddhis, these perfections, these supernormal powers that I was talking about that are in that text, so that he was able to do all these amazing things. He also traveled to Nepal, to Tibet, to Persia, and he taught monism and he denounced idolatry. And he returned to Jerusalem at age 29. So, you know, that the influence of India is definitely pervasive in the New Testament. And well, one stunning example is in the Gospel of John, which opens with the words, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Okay? That particular verse is an exact quote from the Krishna Yajurveda, from a Vedic scripture. It's an exact quote. So
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So Buddhism is, what, about 500 years older than Christianity? Is that right?
Yeah, approximately. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you know how old Hinduism is?
Antiquity. I mean, it's thousands and thousands. I mean, they'll say that it started at the beginning of time. It's like millions of years old. So you can't really get any kind of a grasp or handle on how old it really is, because the Vedas are supposedly scriptures that they're sound vibrations that supposedly gave rise to the entire universe. So that would be kind of old.
That would be old. That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, the Hindu religion has so many gods in it that, you know, are... I think the gods walked the earth, what, about at least 100,000 years ago. I mean, it was a while ago when the gods were here.
Well, they still walk the earth. The gods still walk the earth.
Well, I know, but
you just call upon them, and they'll be right there, and you'll be able to see them, feel them, experience them, and We can all have that experience.
That's true. I'm just talking about when they, you know, when they actually were the flying chariots and all of that were actually, physically here.
Oh, I don't know. So. But Lord Krishna was here in 3000 B.C.
Okay.
His first day was in 3000 B.C., actually.
All right. Well, I'm just trying to get, you know, an idea. But, you know, basically the Eastern religions are a lot older than the Western religions are.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although
for
Judaism goes back quite a ways, but it's, still...
Yeah, it's old, and also the Sumerians. Yeah. People think that that's actually the cradle of civilization, but it isn't.
Right.
The Far East is the cradle of civilization. India is the cradle of civilization, actually. It's the cradle of Western civilization, Sumeria.
Right. I also wanted to mention, and maybe you can elaborate on why there are pine cones, like very large...
Oh, yeah.
Statues of pine cones in the Vatican.
Right. Okay, so the pineal gland, it really was called the pineal gland is because it looks like a little pine cone. In fact, it looks like either a tiny pine cone or a beehive or a corn stalk, really. And the Greeks, named the pineal gland based upon the fact that it looks like the nuts in the pine cone or the pine cone itself. And the symbol of the pine cone is represented as a symbol of highest spiritual illumination throughout the ancient world, including Indonesia, Babylonia, Samaria, Egypt, Greece, Rome, and is prevalent in various esoteric systems, Freemasonry, Theosophy, Gnosticism, Christianity. The beehive is a very common Masonic symbol. The corn stalk is widely used in indigenous tribes of the Americas. But the very largest religious monument in the world is Angkor Wat, and that is found in Cambodia. It has colossal domes that are pine-shaped. It has three colossal domes. And the pine cones, or the beehives, are seen throughout Asia. Looks like the head of Buddha is adorned with a beehive that represents really the South and Central Lotus. And the world's largest pine cone statue is found in the Vatican. in the court of the pine cone, and it's flanked by two peacocks that represent resurrection and immortality.
Right.
And the pine cone also is on the staff of the Pope, and it's in the coat of arms of the Holy See.
Mm-hmm.
Stunning. So in the ancient Greek mythology, there's something called a thyrsus, which is a wand or a staff of the ancient Greeks, is wielded by Dionysus, known in Greek mythology, and Bacchus is the same god in the Roman mythology, and it has a pine cone on the top of it. And the satyrs and the maenads wielded that thyrsus wand. It's made of a stalk of giant fennel plants. It has ivy branches decorated with a ribbon and the pine cone on top. So this pine cone is definitely a symbol of the third eye because it is really a representation of the pineal gland.
Now, in your book, you talk about during the process of awakening the third eye, there are, at least in one system, three different knots that need to be untied so that the energy can flow up. Would you like to talk about that? That's pretty interesting.
Right. Yeah, those are called the grantis. Granti is a Sanskrit word from India. And there are three, they're like psychic knots. They're kind of psychological blocks that prevent us from becoming spiritually awakened. The first psychic block is in the area of the root chakra, or the area of the survival and procreation kind of area in the body. And that is attachment. And the block is the attachment to the material world, the attachment to survival instincts, the attachment to procreation, the basic kind of addiction to that causes fear, causes panic, causes us to feel like we have to hold on to the material life and for survival purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first knot that has to be overcome. Then the second knot is in the area of the heart and the kind of navel areas. So, but mainly the heart area, and that is kind of an attachment to nostalgia, shall we say. An attachment to holding on to things that we feel attached to, love, and loving things, loving the past, loving people that we're attached to, that we want to cling to. It's a kind of a clingy type of love. It's not divine love. It's the love of that people have, romantic love, that kind of thing. So that is the second attachment that needs to be overcome. And then the final one is in the area of the third eye. That's the reason why I talk about it in this book, Awakening the Third Eye, because the third one is actually in the third eye area. And that one is an attachment to feeling superior to other people because you have supernormal powers.
Yeah, right.
So when you develop your spirituality, a lot of people, and I'm sure you've met them in kind of in our circles, in the New Age kind of community, you find people who really think they're all that, you know. They think that they have the answer, they have the key, and that they're definitely superior to the hoi polloi, the masses who are not as smart as we enlightened beings. So that kind of superiority complex, that's the last granti. That's the final block that prevents people from experiencing the true enlightenment, the true nature of their being. Because you can't experience God, you can't experience who you really are, experience your higher self, your true higher self, if you are in your ego consciousness, if you're thinking that you're somehow better or misunderstood or special or different than the rest of humanity. And the reality is, the truth is that everyone is a divine being, that every being walking this planet is divine. Not only human beings, but all sentient beings are divine. And that we are all one. In fact, we're all divine, and we're all part of this oneness, this divinity, this God. We are all part of that. We are all sparks of that, and there's no one who's better than anyone else. That's the reality.
Yeah. And you can have union with all that is if you have the idea that you're separate. So the original sin, if there was one, was the idea of separation.
That's correct. Absolutely. The original sin is separating yourself from divinity. That's right. What that whole allegory is about, the Garden of Eden and all of that. It's about separation from God.
So we just have a few more minutes left, but I want you were talking earlier about Kundalini, but not really. There may be listeners out there that don't understand what it is and why it's stored at the base of the spine and what it means for it to rise up.
Yeah, exactly. So Kundalini is the word itself means curled up. Kundal means curled up. So it's a curled up energy. They call it curled up or coiled up. They call it the mystic coil sometimes or the serpent power. So what that is we talked about pranic energy earlier. Prana, the life force energy, the chi, the ki. This life force energy, which is really what's keeping us alive. It's said in the ancient scriptures of India that when prana is in the body, that is defined as life. And when prana leaves the body, that is what is defined as death.
Right.
So that Kundalini energy is a form of prana. It's a very specialized form of prana. And that Kundalini is a curled-up energy that is seated at the base of the spine in the Muladhara chakra, which is the root chakra. So it's sitting there. In average individuals who have not awakened, who are still kind of stuck in the material sense, who are just seeking pleasures of the flesh and a fear of a survival and that sort of survival instinct, those who are still in that, that Kundalini is just sitting there completely asleep. How it's described in the scriptures, it's described that it's coiled 3.5 times with head down, meaning sleeping. It's asleep. So it has not risen up the spine. There is a specific nadi. Remember the conduits of subtle energy called nadi. There's a specific nadi. It's called Sushumna nadi. And the Kundalini rises through Sushumna nadi. That's the proper place for it to rise up, shall we say. So in some people, it's asleep. But probably everybody who's listening to this show, it's not asleep. You've awakened it to some degree, because if you have any interest in spirituality, if you have any interest in higher knowledge, if you have any interest in the arts, if you have any interest in anything that's other than base instincts, then you have your Kundalini risen to some degree already. And the idea is that when the Kundalini rises all the way from the base of the spine all the way to the top of the head and beyond up to the crown chakra, which is above your head, above your brain, above your skull, when Kundalini has risen and, shall we say, Shakti unites with Shiva, she's the female goddess, and she's sitting at the base of the spine, and when she unites with Shiva, which is at the top of the head, then you have spiritual awakening. When it rises up permanently and doesn't go back down, then you have spiritual awakening. And it rises and goes down, rises, goes down. Continues to do that in most people, really, who are interested in spiritual pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, I think the goal is to walk in meditation during your normal day. In other words, bring that ecstatic meditative state to everything you do. And
exactly.
then to stay in, not in transmission with your thoughts, but in receiving. In other words, your mind is still, so that you may receive impressions and gather information from a higher level of awareness to help you along, to help you maintain
exactly.
Your balance, and to help you maintain like wisdom going through the day.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Know what's real, what's not real. Know what might happen. So what I do around this, I mean, I have 30 employees. I anticipate what's going to go wrong, and then I give instructions so that they will not make that mistake. Do you see?
That's good. Yeah.
No, seriously, I do it in surgery all the time. Mm-hmm. And then if they don't do what I ask them to do and the mistake happens, I remind them that, look, I'm being given this information for protection of the patient.
Right.
You know, you got to listen to what I say because this information isn't coming from me.
Right.
You know, it's coming from
exactly.
helpers and guides and guardian angels and whatever you want to say to help prevent problems later on. So,
exactly.
But if everybody walked in that energy, we would have a much different world.
That would be called heaven on earth.
That's right. That's right. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour here. Would you like to give your contact information?
Oh, sure. I have a website. It's drsusan.org. That's drsusan.org. And on that website, you can read the first chapter of every one of my books. You can hear for free. You can hear teleseminars. You can read articles. And there's a lot on that website. So you might enjoy visiting that, drsusan.org. Then I have another website. It's divinetravels.com. That's divinetravels. That's plural on divinetravels.com. And there you're going to find out about the retreats, the sacred tours, tours to sacred destinations. You'll find out about amazing cruise ship seminars that I put on more than once a year with really famous, wonderful speakers. And I think if you would just subscribe there on that particular page, then you'll be notified of the upcoming things that are taking place, because not everything is on that website at any given time. It changes all the time. So it's a good idea to subscribe there, and then you'll be notified of the next great event that's going to be happening that you can participate in. These are amazing events, by the way. And I think
I'm sure they are. I think I'm going to go subscribe. I would love to hear about them. Well,
cool.
Thank you so much for joining us, Susan. It's been a great hour, a very enlightening hour. Not that many people are able to speak about all of these technical details that we've covered in the hour. And I think that your exercises in the book will be very, very helpful for people who are seeking to awaken their third eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they really work, and they're simple. Anyone can do them.
Great. Well, we've been interviewing Dr. Susan Shumsky. Her book, Awakening Your Third Eye, How Accessing Your Sixth Sense Can Help You Find Knowledge, Illumination, and Intuition. Please avail yourself of the exercises, and it will greatly help you on your path to spiritual awakening. Thanks a lot for joining us, Susan.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and I really loved all the questions you asked. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, next week we're going to be interviewing Sonia Barrett, Health and Inside Job and Outside Business, and then Stephanie Banks is going to be talking about A Soulful Awakening, and then on the 15th, Lisa Barnett, The Infinite Wisdom of the Akashic Records. Thank you very much for joining us on Temple of Health Radio Show.